To continue with our medical theme that we've had over the past few weeks, my guest this week is the Dean and Professor of the Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine at UNT here in Fort Worth. He oversees the day-to-day operations of the medical school. This is a different medical school than what Dr. Flynn is running from a few weeks back. If you happen to listen to that episode, you're going to learn a lot on this one, so enjoy. Go ahead and subscribe now and share with a friend. Thanks. Dr. Filippetto, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'd love to kick things off, have you explain kind of what your role is at UNT Health Science Center?
Yeah, my current role is I'm the current dean for the Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine. It's a medical school that's been in Fort Worth for the last 50 years. We'll be coming up on our 50th anniversary in 2020, so I'm the current dean there. Prior to that, I served as the chair of family medicine at TCOM and then the associate dean for academic affairs.
Okay, very nice. I think it would be interesting to sort of set the stage and explain what exactly osteopathic medicine is and how that is different than traditional or say what TCU and UNT are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to first start off by explaining why or how osteopathic medicine actually came about. I'll give you some idea of what, at least in its inception of osteopathic medicine, how it was different. Osteopathic medicine started in the late 1800s, and it was actually created by Dr. Still, who was actually an allopathic physician at the time, and created this new form of medicine because at the time, the current form of medicine, traditional medicine at that time, wasn't really doing what it was intended to do. It was actually likely causing more harm than actually good. So this allopathic physician, who was actually a surgeon in the Civil War, came up with a new way of thinking about healthcare at the time. And he basically had a philosophy or developed a philosophy that focused on the body's innate ability to keep itself healthy as long as you did your part in keeping it healthy. So that's why osteopathic physicians tend to have a lot of pride and emphasis on preventative medicine and thinking about patients in a more holistic, empathetic fashion.
Yeah.
So that, so again, it came out of a necessity, again, over a century ago, because the current, at that particular time, the current form of medicine wasn't doing what it was needing to do.
Yeah. That need is obviously even greater now than probably even back then. As far as like preventive health and what you're teaching the doctors of tomorrow, what are some ways that we can all get better at preventive medicine?
Yeah, absolutely. The if we look at the if we look at the tenets of osteopathic medicine and the philosophy, and again, what created our profession, there's a couple tenets that again we teach our students, and we hope that as practicing osteopathic physicians, they implement this right in their daily practice of medicine. The first tenet is thinking of a person or a patient per se as an entire unit consisting of mind, body, and spirit. So when we train our students to think of a patient, we don't train them to think of a patient with a particular disease, right? This is a person, right? A human person who with a lot of things that are contributing to their particular health, right? So again, whether it's how they take care of themselves, what they bring to the table from the standpoint of mind, body, and spirit, we teach them to how to integrate all of those aspects to create either a treatment plan or a preventative plan for them, right? So, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all for every patient. So understanding, again, where patients come from, who they are, what they believe in is very, very important, right?
Yeah.
We can't, for example, I can't tell every patient, you need to exercise 30 minutes a day, right? That's, we all know that we need to do that.
Yeah.
But understanding, again, who your patients are and being more patient-centered, understanding who that patient is and understanding, what else is going on in their life allows us to be more patient-centered and create a treatment plan or healthcare plan that suits that particular person.
Yeah, very interesting.
It makes sense.
Yeah, that's great. I had Dr. Flynn on a couple weeks ago, and we talked a lot about the future of medicine and different things like that. Mm-hmm. What are some predictions you have from your perspective, I guess, running the other med school here in town?
Predictions about medicine and where medicine's going. Obviously, it has to change, right?
Yeah.
It has to change. So I think the biggest prediction is, I think, the role of the physician, how it's going to change. You know, I'm looking at artificial intelligence right now and how artificial intelligence and technology is actually going to change what physicians do on a daily basis, right? Everyday physicians are out there trying to process data from patients, right? When we take histories and when we do physical exams on patients, that's all types of data. And based on the data that we collect, we have to make decisions, whether it's diagnosis or treatment plan. But there's a lot more data out there that can help us in order to make better decisions, better informed decisions, and decisions that are more precise for a particular patient, not a particular disease. So artificial intelligence, again, is going to do a much, much better job at processing data, collecting data, data that we as physicians, as humans, may never even consider to be important, and process at a blink of an eye. So we'll go more from data processors to actually physicians who can, again, use data to, again, implement and discuss with patients the best treatment and how to take care of yourself.
That's great. And that's good to hear. I mean, is that a few years away? I mean, part of that's probably happening today, but I guess just as a consumer of healthcare and going to my primary care, I guess I'm not seeing that quite yet. I'd be interested to hear your perspective on that.
No, there's some forms of artificial intelligence out there right now.
Yeah,
so,
good.
So there are companies that have actually developed ways to interpret, for example, x-rays. You know, your radiologists, for example, have to look at an x-ray and they have to decide, you know, what they're looking at, what a diagnosis is, what's going on with that particular patient. So they're already developed artificial intelligence that can look at an x-ray now and come up with even more accurate diagnosis. Now, at the crux of all that, you need radiologists and physicians to actually set up the rules that determine what a computer does.
Mm-hmm.
But what artificial intelligence does, it's actually machine, it's called machine learning.
Yeah.
The machine actually starts to learn, right?
The more data it gets.
And the more data it gets and it processes, just like, again, we as physicians learn over time through experience.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't eliminate actually the role of a physician. It just is going to assist physicians, again, to process data much quicker and hopefully much more accurately. So we have some of that already going on.
Yeah, to take a step back, I've had a number of different guests on the podcast, and we've talked about physician shortages in different ways from the recruitment standpoint. Can you briefly explain like how the residency program actually works? I've never truly understood how that program works, and I have family members and friends that are doctors, but I think just briefly explaining how that program works and who controls it.
Right. So residencies, or what we call graduate medical education. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So medical schools are undergraduate medical education. We train, again, students to become physicians. So after someone graduates from medical school, a student will have to go on and do additional training. Now, that additional training is more directed towards a particular specialty. So medical schools, again, train and graduate physicians with a more of a broad set of skills. And so residencies create an opportunity, again, for physicians to get additional training in a specific specialty that they eventually want to practice in and eventually become board certified in.
Yeah.
And those specialties are the things that you commonly hear of: family medicine, pediatricians, obstetricians, surgeons, right? So they're all different types of specialties. Now, the way this typically works is most, but not all, residencies are somehow overseen or directed by a hospital system.
Okay.
So
that's
they're hospital-based, but not all of them are. There are some, again, forms of GME that are done in community-based, in clinics, and other types of organizations. But what happens is the federal government, through Medicare payments, actually funds GME and GME residencies. So money flows from the federal government to hospitals to run these residency programs. The issue that we have recently with, you talked about the health, the physician shortage.
Yeah.
Has a lot to do with GME also, all right? So more and more medical schools are expanding their class size.
Yeah, exactly.
We are seeing new medical schools pop up, similar to the one we have in town here with TCU. Probably the fastest growing healthcare workforce are osteopathic physicians.
That's good. Good for you.
So we are probably the fastest growing. We've actually increased our numbers by 50% in the past decade.
Wow. Right,
with the number of students and number of people we expect to graduate. But the problem is with residency programs, mm-hmm. right? So we can have more and more students graduate, but if we don't have the concomitant increase in GME position or residency positions, right, we're never going to solve the healthcare shortage. And we need to have those residency positions in the right area, in the right parts of the country, in Texas, in those rural areas, right, for our students to train in, so that hopefully they remain there when they finish their residency, mm-hmm. right? So as GME gets funded by the federal government through Medicare, there's only so many positions the federal government can fund.
Mm-hmm.
And that number was set in the late 1990s, 1996, 1997.
A little dated.
Right. So we call that the cap. So hospitals are capped with the number of residency positions that they can receive funding from the government for to actually run residency programs. So although we have a lot of maybe hospital systems or organizations who want to create residency programs, funding them becomes a little bit more difficult if they are either at their cap or if their cap is so low that they can't, you know, expand. So okay. They have to find other innovative ways of funding GME. Now, we're fortunate in Texas because Texas legislature has created funding within the state for organizations, universities, hospital systems to expand GME. So I have to say within the state of Texas, we're kind of advanced for that.
That's good.
Because we are at a crucial part in Texas because the number of students that we graduate every year in Texas medical schools equals the number of residency positions that we have available in Texas. And although that sounds good that we have equal numbers, mm-hmm. it's not so good. We need to have a surplus of GME positions in Texas for the number of students who graduate if we're going to grow responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
And again, putting those residency positions in places that are needed, not just creating residencies, but where they're needed and in those specialties that are needed, such as primary care.
Yeah. Interesting. That makes total sense. I didn't realize that those were federally funded programs. Mm-hmm. I thought if Baylor or THR wanted more residents, they were paying for them themselves.
That's an option.
And still have that option.
A lot of hospitals could do that. Right? A lot of hospitals can fund GME positions out of their own reserves, out of mm-hmm. their own finances. However, that becomes a little bit difficult for some hospitals.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Becomes difficult, especially
in smaller towns,
rural hospitals where the margins aren't great enough to invest in that, right?
Yeah.
So, GME positions can be funded privately also, right?
Okay.
For example, I've know of some GME positions, for example, and some subspecialties such as dermatology, where a group of physicians will actually fund a residency, right?
Okay.
And partner with a medical school to make sure it's run properly. Now, all residencies have to go through a process of accreditation. So they're all held to the same level of scrutiny. But it doesn't matter who funds them. It's been funded by through the Medicare system.
All right. I appreciate you clarifying that. You hit on it briefly there with small town hospitals and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You guys have a program called The Roam, I believe, where it's helping put residents in smaller towns and different. I hopefully got that correct, but I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Sure. The Roam program at the Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine, Roam stands for Rural Osteopathic Medical Education, R-O-M-E. So the Roam program is a parallel educational track that some of our students elect to enter. So again, we admit about 230 students to TCOM a year into the medical school. at some point during the first semester of their first year, we try to recruit students who want to focus their career in rural Texas. So we have a curriculum that runs parallel to our traditional curriculum. So they get additional training. They take some additional coursework that helps them prepare them to practice in rural Texas or rural America for that matter, right? So the selection process is pretty intense. So we have a lot of students who want to enter into the rural track program. Mm-hmm. But because, again, it requires a little bit more additional coursework and more time and effort where we carefully select. We also want to select students who truly, truly want to practice in rural because it's a big investment. So we have about 20 to 25 students a year that we enroll in this program. And again, additional skills, additional knowledge, and with the hope that when they graduate, they enter a rural residency in Texas. Or if they don't do a rural residency in Texas, they end up practicing in a rural area after they finish their residency. So again, you know, part of what we do at TCOM when we recruit students is we recruit students based on what we call non-cognitive variables. So it's not just about how smart you are, what your grades are mm-hmm. when you've been in college. We look for students that have a tendency to want to give back, want to serve the underserved, whether it's rural or whether it's underserved in urban areas, right? So we place a lot of emphasis on the non-cognitive variables. So those other special traits that, again, help fulfill our mission, help fulfill what osteopathic philosophy is all about.
Yeah. Just curious, what are the additional training or courses that these students go through that are serving? I'm just interested in that.
Sure. So, I could just give you some of the maybe the curricular aspects. So they'll be better trained at learning how to use telemedicine, for example, okay. right? Because when you're in a rural area, you may not have access to all the specialists that you need. So mm-hmm. knowing how to do telemedicine, for example, is great. They get a little bit more training on public health. Some of the things that occur in rural areas are a little bit different that occur in, say, urban areas. So a little bit more background in public health aspects of what happens in rural America. Some of the other things may include, in the particular curriculum, we start placing our students in rural Texas as soon as they start here. So as soon as they get accepted in the rural track, we place them in the community, in a rural community, during their medical school. So while they're studying in classrooms, we hook them up into a community where they do some service. So they develop that kind of, you know, small town rural connection, which is really important to keep someone there. So they're just some of the aspects that we do.
I grew up in small towns, so that makes total sense. You also have a Fast Track program. Love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's our pipeline program. So about 5-6 years ago, again, the Texas legislature created a grant program and funding for medical schools to create innovative ways to increase the number of students who go into primary care practice. Primary care being things like family medicine, pediatrics, general internal medicine. So we came up with this idea where we would partner with West Texas, in this particular case, Midland County.
Okay.
Midland being an area that, again, is underserved. It may not necessarily be considered as rural as some areas of Texas, but it's still underserved. They don't have a whole lot of primary care physicians to take care of their population. So we recognize that, and we developed some partnerships within Midland. So we developed partnerships with Midland Community College and the hospital in Midland County, Midland Memorial Hospital. Students who were in Midland, right, they tend not to have great access to going into the typical 4-year college programs. So our idea was, how are we going to get students who grew up in Midland, who have ties to Midland, may want to become a physician, and likely stay in Midland to be, you know, provide that needed care. So again, we know through statistics and research that if you grew up in an area, went to school in an area, were trained in an area, including your residency, mm-hmm. that typically you'll stay in that area when you're done and when you practice. So that's our idea. Mm-hmm. So we had this idea of looking for students who typically may not have had any opportunity to go to medical school. And these are students who, again, may have been going into community college. And we said, let's recruit you into this pipeline program from Midland. You'll do 2 years in Midland Community College, maintain a certain GPA and a certain level of performance. We'll have you do 1 year at UNT in Denton to continue your coursework. And then after 3 years, you'll come to TCOM. So that's what we've done. And we have our first set of students who are in TCOM now in that program. Okay. So they do 2 years in Midland Community College. You're in Denton, and now they're in TCOM. So it's a fast track from the standpoint. It shaves a year off the typical four-year undergraduate degree, but also creates opportunity for students who may have not had an opportunity to go through the traditional way, four-year undergraduate, and then go into medical school, right? So now when those students enter TCOM, they'll still do some studying at TCOM, but then they have to go and do their clinical rotations where they actually work in hospitals. All those students will go back and do their clinical studies in Midland Memorial Hospital, which we've already developed a relationship with.
Very nice. I'd like to jump back. I failed to ask one question around really the Rome program and small town hospitals. You see a lot of news of these hospitals shutting down and having trouble to operate in smaller towns. Do you think it's going towards this like telehealth and doing the primary care kind of like you've talked about in anything specialty? They pretty much have to come to a DFW or a Houston, or do you see anything that is a little more optimistic than what you read?
Well, no, I'm optimistic. And again, we have to think about a different way of providing that care. Mm-hmm. And telemedicine is just one way of doing it.
That's good for a very small subset of things.
And we're getting more sophisticated with it, right? Probably there are some forms of medicine that can be better given in the form of telemedicine. Probably the biggest one and probably the largest shortage we have is in mental health and how we deliver psychiatric care and mental health. And that's an easy way of being able to deliver in a telemedicine format, right? Some of the other things we've done at UNTHSC and within TCOM too is how do we provide care into the community that doesn't have access? So some innovative ways is how do we partner with schools and school districts and with nurses, right, within a particular school, you know? So we've created at UNTHSC a program where we can take care of children with asthma, for example, through kind of a telemedicine format, right? So that student doesn't necessarily have to go to a hospital, get treated, or to be assessed, or to a doctor's office. We can actually, again, through telemedicine, screen a patient in a school or in a school nurse's office and say, okay, this is what you need to do. This is not what you need to do. Oh, this child looks really, really sick. You need to send them to a doctor. We need to get them to a hospital. So again, telemedicine is one way of doing it. I could tell you there are newer ways of funding, graduate medical education in rural areas that now we're starting to get involved in. So there are some funds both at the state and federal level where it's creating more opportunities for us to get more implanted in rural Texas or rural parts of the country to develop those training programs. Again, it's a tough uphill battle.
Yeah.
It's definitely in a tough hill battle, and it's going to take a lot of work, a lot of investment, a lot of money to do this.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're more optimistic than definitely what you read in the news. That's good.
You have to be optimistic, right? So again, I think we can't look at this as, you know, because we failed in the past or lost cause. Again, innovation to me is important. We have to think from an entrepreneurial mindset, right? We have to think, how do we solve these problems? We may not have those solutions now, but again, part of what I have to do as dean is train a different type of medical student. Mm-hmm. And we're always going to train good doctors to take care.
The foundation.
We're always going to have a good foundational training of our physicians. But my role as a dean is, how do I train a student to think entrepreneurially, if that's a word, right?
Yeah.
Entrepreneurial mind, that's solving problems, because today's students, right, they're the ones who are going to have to solve healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
My generation maybe dropped the ball on healthcare, right? That's why we have some of these healthcare issues and healthcare problems. But I'm confident that, again, our new generation here has the capacity. We have to train them to be entrepreneurs, think a little bit differently than what we typically used to think of in training medical students. When I was trained, we were trained differently. Right? Mm-hmm. It's a different mindset, and that's what we have to do. We have to create a different provider of the future.
Yeah, this is all very good to hear. I mean, how do you stay on top of all this information? I mean, a lot of the stuff you hit on is fairly innovative and more, I guess, business focused. You would think a dean of a med school might just be laser focused on producing the best doctor of tomorrow. Uh-huh. But I'm just curious how you kind of stay on top of and where you get some of that information.
Well, I'm fortunate, right? We're at a great university, right? Yeah, great university, there's a lot of great minds, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not just me. This is all teamwork, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So again, we think of these things, we get together, we talk about them. Again, nationally, there are things that are happening, innovation. So a lot of reading and a lot of more reading. But again, team-based approach, sharing ideas. Some of the greatest ideas that we've had don't come from deans. They don't come from presidents of universities. You know who they come from? Patients, because we listen to patients. They come from some of our medical students, right? They come from the community. So again, having this open kind of dialogue about how can we do things differently? We're going to fail at most of them. But the difference in, again, how I was trained years ago in medicine and how we want to train students differently, I was never allowed to fail as a medical student.
Okay.
I was, right, failure and risk-taking from an entrepreneurial standpoint, right, is not kind of looked at favorably in medicine right now, right? So, again, so finding those type of students who are more entrepreneurial thinking, that are willing to take risk, and if they fail, are not punished because they're failing, right? Because in order to solve problems, you have to fail at things, right? Mm-hmm. Different mindset, again, that we're trying to teach our students, right? And as well as our faculty and other physicians. Again, it's a culture shift.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Just curious, from your perspective, why is healthcare innovation lacking?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. Healthcare is too complex right now,
mm-hmm.
right? So when you think of the complexity of healthcare, there's multiple stakeholders with their own agenda. So when you have agendas that's often clash, that can sometimes stall innovation.
Yeah, and you've and patients aren't typically paying for it with health insurance and things like that. Right. Makes for some interesting dynamics.
Right. The cost, you know, innovation costs money. You want to start up something new or you want to create something new, it costs money. You have to invest in it, right? The difference in investing in healthcare is a little bit different than investing in other things, right? Because in healthcare, between regs, proving your concept, right? Making sure something's safe, perhaps, can take 10 years. Investors and innovators tend not to want to wait that long sometimes.
Yeah,
they want to see things turn around pretty quick. So that sometimes will stall innovation. One of the biggest things is the healthcare sector itself. Again, like I talked about before, we don't like to take risks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Risk in medicine, right, is a four-letter word. It actually is a four-letter word, right?
Yeah.
Right? It's a risk. So we're not accustomed to taking risks as physicians. So that's a different type of culture that we have to change.
Okay.
Right? And the other thing is, I don't know that we've always trained our students to think differently and to think innovatively, right? Because again, we don't like students taking risks. But again, that's what we're doing, especially at UNT, HSC, and TCOM, is introducing this entrepreneurial type of training to change their thinking a little bit so that they're comfortable taking risks, they're comfortable in learning how to solve problems, and hopefully become more innovative in the future.
That is great to hear. I mean, between what you're doing and what Dr. Flynn is doing, I think the area should have some very good doctors in the future. I'd love to wrap it up with a few easy questions.
Uh-huh.
You probably interview hundreds of students, or over the years, you definitely have. What is one of your favorite interview questions?
What is your purpose? What is your purpose? What gets you up in the morning? And, you know, why do you get up every morning?
Yeah.
Okay. So whether I'm interviewing a student or whether I'm interviewing a faculty member or another employee at my school, right? My favorite question, what is your purpose? What gets you up in the morning? What gets you excited? Because if that purpose doesn't mesh with what we do as in medicine or in healthcare or at our institution, you likely won't be happy.
Yeah.
So it's all about purpose and what your why is. What is your why?
Yeah, you hear a lot about that these days. Just curious, how do you personally stay healthy yourself given the demands of your job?
At the end of the day, I make sure that I always reserve time for myself, right? Again, being a dean is a busy job, has a lot of stressors. But I make it a point. I make it a point to reserve time every day to do something for myself. Now, that something for myself may be different every day. It may be exercising, right? I participate in a weekly men's ice hockey team.
Okay.
Right? That's my outlet. I love ice hockey as a
very
sport.
Cool.
I came from North. That's a sport that I love to follow, and I like to play it, right? So, so once a week, I get together with a bunch of other guys. Some of them are physicians. And again, for 2.5 hours a week, I have nothing on my mind except chasing a black little rubber thing around the rink.
Right? Yeah.
So again, it's physical. It's also mental, right? Well-being. The other things that I do, again, I like to get out in the outdoors. I like to hunt and fish, particularly fishing. I spend about 30 minutes every night after I eat dinner and I tie flies.
Okay. You sound like my dad.
Right? So for 30 minutes, again, it helps me decompress. I get things out of my head again. And obviously you want to spend time with your family. So again, a couple hours every day has to be for myself. And you have to give yourself permission to do that, you know? And every job we have, again, we tend to get so invested in our jobs that we forget about giving ourselves permission to take care of ourselves. That's the first step, is to give you permission and then to say, it's okay to do that.
Yeah, that is a great place to end it. I'm just curious, where is the closest ice rink? I didn't even know Fort Worth had one.
Yeah, Richland Hills.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they have a NYTEX, they have a skating rink there. The minor league hockey team actually plays there.
Okay.
But they open it up to the public.
Very cool. Well, Dr. Filippetta, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. I appreciate this. It was a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
Thanks for giving the show a listen. Please do me a favor before you stop listening. Subscribe on whatever platform you're on. If you loved it so much and you've already subscribed, share this episode with a friend. Thanks again, and I'll see you next week.
Matt McGee is an employee of Frost Insurance. All opinions shared by Matt or guests of the Healthy Conversations podcast are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Frost Insurance or Frost Bank. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for insurance, banking, or investment advice. Healthy Conversations with Matt McGee is brought to you by Straight Up Podcasts.